please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're going to be talking with James P. Harris, or JP as he likes to be called. And he is an employment attorney and litigator with Sheehan, Finney, Bass & Green, attorney firm in Manchester, New Hampshire. And today we're going to be talking about bulletproof documentation. JP, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you. Well, this is a great topic because there is no HR professional that I know out there that can say we have bulletproof documentation.
Well, I understand that. We certainly want to strive for that. I come from this in the context of a litigator who's litigating disputes between employers and employees, and the first thing we do is try to see what the documents tell us, to see what was recorded at the time, and so we're trying to provide the lessons that we learn in that context to HR professionals so we can try to mitigate those risks as best we can.
So we're going to basically covering at least three topics today, and of course I'm sure we'll get off topic because that's what happens here on the show. But we're going to start with what we call documenting ordinary events, things that happen every day. So why don't you start with some workplace policies, how you should handle common HR files?
Sure. I'm sure everybody out there by now receives acknowledgments back from employees saying that they've received and understand the HR manual or the employment manual, and that's a good practice. A lot of employers have employees sign off on acknowledgments that they've received certain additional policies that might apply to them, and that's obviously a good practice. One tip that we're trying to get employers to do now these days is to document the fact that employees had an opportunity to read and review these policies before they were called upon to sign on them. So, in other words, we're not just advising employers to have employees sign saying, yes, I've read and received, but to also have some document in the file that indicates that the employee was allowed to take this policy home for the weekend, had a chance to read it over, and came back in on Monday and signed it. In other words, we want to have some document in the file indicating that the employees had the chance to really take the time and review it, and they didn't just show up on the first day and had someone stand over them watching them sign forms in a stack.
So should this be on the acknowledgement form itself? Is there something that says, I have hereby, and I'm not saying that this is the language, but I've hereby had the opportunity to have this form have this handbook for 24 hours, and then I've read it and acknowledge and go through the rest of the acknowledgement. Are you looking at something like that to kind of give a characteristic about an amount of time that they've given them?
Right, that's not a bad way to do it. The other way to do it from the HR side is for your new hire checklist, to fill in the blank that says, I provided the new employee the handbook on January 22nd, and I got it back on the 24th, or whatever the dates are. So even on the employer side, as part of your checklist for the new hire process, you've got some entry in your file that indicates that there was some period of time for the employees to read and review the policies before they signed off.
We've talked about the handbook part, but this also applies to offer letters, especially when we're talking about commissions or sales programs. Talk to me a little bit about if there's anything unique to that aspect of it.
There are really two tricks to that part of it. On the sales side, the burden is on the employer to spell out in writing when commissions are earned. Many times employers spell out when commissions are paid, and that's kind of the easy part. But if the employer's practice is to not consider commissions to be earned until the invoice is paid, until money comes in the door, that needs to be spelled out. And so you need to have it's helpful to have the policy spelled out in writing, certainly, and have a salesperson sign off acknowledging that, yes, I understand that even if I book a sale, I may not get credit for that sale right away. I have to wait until money comes in the door. Where this becomes particularly difficult is at the end of the employment relationship, when the salesperson leaves, and you have to go back and calculate and figure out whether commissions need to be paid on particular sales at the end of the employment relationship. The other trick that applies more generally to any employee who's called upon to sign a restrictive covenant, a non-compete, a non-disclosure, a non-solicitation agreement, the New Hampshire legislature passed a new law last summer that requires presentation of that restrictive, that non-compete, before the employee accepts the offer. So, again, this is an instance where the legislature stepped in and said you need to document that you've provided the applicant, in this instance, an opportunity to take that non-compete home, read it, and review it before they agree to accept your offer of employment.
So when somebody is taking the time to review this, and do you recommend that they have a sign-off for each thing separately, or can there be just a, as you put it, a sheet that has all the different things on it that, that the employer and the employee has to sign off on?
I think you can cover them with, well, for restrictive covenants, non-competes, non-disclosures, that should certainly be in a separate document that the employee is going to sign specifically. With respect to your sort of general workplace policies, that can be covered, I think, in a blanket acknowledgement. You might have some employees, depending on what department they work in or whether they have access to certain areas of confidential information or certain job duties that might have policies that might apply to them and not others. And another example might be perhaps the company pays for smartphones for management, and you'd want to lay out in a policy the agreement between the company and the employee about personal use of the cell phone and so forth. Because that policy wouldn't apply necessarily to your entire workforce, but only to that subset, that's an instance where you'd have a separate policy laid out on a couple of sheets of paper and have that management type sign off on the acknowledgement on that policy.
Got it. All right, so we've taken care of a little bit talking about what we would say is signed acknowledgements having to do with sign-offs for, we might say, sexual harassment training. You might say employee handbooks. Now we're talking about, you know, non-competes. Are there any other places where employers should be thinking about having them sign off when it comes to maybe job descriptions, trainings?
You did mention a good one there, and that is attendance at training sessions. Having employees sign off on a roster sheet saying that they attended a particular training. And keeping a copy of any written materials that was provided to the attendees at that meeting. I can't tell you the number of times it's helpful as a litigator to be able to go back in time and demonstrate that so-and-so attended a sensitivity training or other training session to prove that that person was actually there. Job descriptions are also very, very helpful for litigators because accurate and thorough job descriptions lay out the expectations by the employer, and so it helps fend off claims that employers either changed the job descriptions or added to the duties in an effort to retaliate or discriminate against the employee. So having detailed and thorough job descriptions that the employee signs off on when they take the job is really helpful from our perspective. And we recognize, of course, that keeping job descriptions up to date is a big task. It puts a lot of pressure on HR professionals and supervisors to do that. One thing we try to get people to think about is to see if they can pick one month every year where that's going to be the month where they're going to audit job descriptions. So if June is a slow month, if there ever are any slow months, you know, every June we're going to go through the following departments and we're just going to take a look at the job descriptions and make sure that they're accurate and up to date.
One of the things that I know employers always struggle with, and when they're talking about their paperwork, quote unquote paperwork, is, you know, this, how do I handle personnel files or employee files? There seems to be so many different ways in which now we have to look at an employee file. You know, you have to separate certain things. You can't put them all in the same file. You got to segregate medical things. You got to segregate I-9s. You need to put them in certain orders. There's such this. I mean, every time I talk to HR professionals, you can almost see their eyes glaze over and the roll back in their head in terms of all this stuff that has to be taken care of. What's your take on a simple way for them to understand? And of course, you're going to tell me there probably isn't one. But you know, what is a simple way for them to understand how they should handle personnel records?
Well, the not so simple answer is that the regulations, of course, define personnel files very broadly. Any documents pertaining to the employment fall within the definition of a personnel file, and that means that the employee has a right to access that information. Now, you've mentioned some good tips, keeping I-9 separate, keeping medical information in separate folders. Those are good tips. Beyond that, we all know that HR professionals generate a fair amount of paperwork to document sort of ordinary changes along the way during the employee's tenure, changes in job status, raises, promotions. Those are sort of the easy documents, I think, to sort of keep track of. The more difficult documents are the more discretionary items, disciplinary actions, performance evaluations, and there's a real art to the performance evaluation piece of this. But those documents, there really isn't a better answer than to say they're part of the personnel file. The tip really that we can impart to people is you need to think of them as public documents. You need to have this little spot in the back of your mind that tells you that someday this employment relationship is going to end. It might end on perfectly great terms, but it might end on bad terms, and the documents in that personnel file may see the light of day some point way down in the future. And so you, as an HR professional, you always have to have that little spot reserved in the back of your mind that reminds you these might be made public someday, and how would we feel about what's stated in these documents several years down the road.
Today we're talking with J.P. Harris. He is a litigator and employment attorney at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. And we're going to be right back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
We asked kids what it took to be a dad. This is what they had to say.
A father is always present. I mean, what real father figure can you have if they're not there?
In order to be a good dad, you need to love your son. You need to put gas in your car so you don't break down in the middle of nowhere. And you need to make them breakfast. Yep.
I mean, just to maybe play like a board game with me, or to just stay home and play some video games with me. Just to do like that one little thing is what I really look forward to.
I'm not asking him to be a perfect dad, but he should try.
He's just a constant force in my life.
There's no other type of love like a dad's love, because it's not comparable to anything else.
Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by cmacareer.com. And we are talking with J.P. Harris. He's an attorney and litigator with the attorney firm Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. And today we're talking about bulletproof documentation. J.P., thanks for being on the show.
Yep, thank you for having me.
No problem. So in the first segment, we kind of talked a little bit about the overview of sign-offs and different things that go in the file. And we kind of ended the segment talking about employee files themselves, and you provided a couple tips. Let's talk about some specific things in the HR files that people can get some tips and information from. And we'll start with my favorite, your favorite, the I-9.
Our big tip there, the basic tip there, is to keep the I-9 separate from the rest of the personnel file, and this relates to the audit rights afforded by the government officials. So our real tip is just to keep it separate from the I-9 so that if, in the event you are audited, you don't have to turn over the entire personnel file that would include medical information and other things that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily want to turn over.
So when somebody has an I-9 and they are terminated, the I-9 goes then into, of course, a separate terminated I-9 file. How long should somebody keep those I-9s?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because I can point you to the regulations that say you keep them for X amount of time. But when I work with companies on their record management policies, I try to get them to think in terms of setting 2 or 3 retention periods for all of their HR files. And one of them is going to be a permanent file. One would be a period, let's say, of employment plus several years, and then another one would be a much shorter period, 2 or 3 years. The point I'm trying to convey is that you could end up with a record retention schedule that has 10 or 12 different retention periods on it, and it's very difficult for any employee to try to comply with a schedule that looks like that. So I try to work with employers to come up with a schedule that really only has 2 or 3 periods. And this would fall, these I-9s would fall in that whatever the shorter period, which is usually 2 or 3 years, that people would select. And obviously, if, as you mentioned, for employees that you retain for a significant period of time, they remain in their personnel file, and you'd keep the personnel file for the length of employment plus several years after that.
Okay, the second thing would be hiring documents, things that certainly are applications, resumes, new hire forms, things that have to do with interviewing, documents that have to do with, you know, questions for interview, reference checks, all that documentation.
Well, that's right. And there's another piece to it, too, that you should keep records regarding the unsuccessful applicants. You want to be mindful of a claim by an unsuccessful applicant that they were not chosen for some discriminatory reason. So what you want to do is keep records on not only the people that you hire. Those records will go into the person's personnel file, and you'll keep them in the ordinary course. But there's also a period of time that you want to retain documents relating to the unsuccessful applicants. So any applications or other materials you get from people you end up not hiring, you'll hold on to for a period of time. Usually that period of time is tied to the statute of limitations for a discrimination claim or filing a notice with the Human Rights Commission. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has promulgated some regulations suggesting you keep those for a year. That's generally speaking the types of advice we're giving to employers. The other tricky part that comes up more frequently these days is the use of social media to vet candidates. And that creates a bit of a trap for some employers because you unwillingly can learn information about applicants that you might otherwise try to avoid in the hiring process. You can go to someone's Facebook profile and find out what church they go to. You can learn a lot of information about what groups they affiliate themselves with. You might learn things about medical conditions that you otherwise would try to avoid in the hiring process. So it's very important these days for employers to have written policies laying out what social media sites they're going to search, and they need to search them for all applicants, or at least those that make the final cut. And it's because you want to treat everybody uniformly so that there will be no claim coming back to you that you utilized improper information in deciding not to hire a candidate. Another tip is to segregate out the person who searches through social media or on the internet for information about applicants, to keep that person separate from the decision maker on the hiring side. So in other words, you'll have one person actually review the social media accounts and just distill out sort of the objective information that you'd want utilized in your hiring decision and pass along only that information to the person who actually makes the hiring decision. That way you filter out religious affiliations and medical information and other information that you'd want to keep separated from the employment decision itself.
We're talking with J.P. Harris. He is an employment attorney and litigator for the law firm Sheehan, Finney, Bass & Green. And we're talking about bulletproof documentation. You know, the other thing, and you mentioned it just a little bit, had to do with medical records or medical information. Talk to me about how that should be handled in regards to HR files or just in general in terms of when somebody brings in a doctor's note, somebody brings in something having to do with information on someone's medical history.
Yep. Well, in general, I think most people have learned to keep the medical information separate from the general personnel file, and that's driven in large part by an effort to preserve confidentiality. To keep medical information out of employment-related decisions as much as possible. But another important point to emphasize is, again, to document the process, the requests for information. If you're having problems with an employee providing information, not being as forthright as you'd want, to document that you've made several requests and so forth, this is another instance where documenting the process being followed is very important. On a similar vein, documenting the process followed when an employee requests an accommodation is also very important. You want to emphasize in a document that's created contemporaneously that there was a deliberative and collaborative process to try to work out the accommodation, that the employee was engaged, that several options were presented to the employee, and to try to actually lay out the decision process for how one accommodation was selected over another. So that's another instance where an HR professional can really help document the process that was followed and help buttress the conclusion that the process was fair.
Following within the medical aspect, we do have workplace injuries that happen. People get hurt on the job sometimes. Documentation is critical, obviously key. It may involve medical information. It may just involve accident reports or documentation that has to be done, especially for OSHA. What's your takeaway in terms of some tips and things that HR professionals, business owners have to think about, maybe even safety managers have to think about in this area?
Well, of course, a lot of the obligations on employers in this field are governed by regulation and by statute. And so you have obligations to timely report incidents, of course, and to participate through the workers' comp process. You'll have other OSHA obligations imposed on you. So a lot of what happens in this area is dictated on employers by regulation and by statute. Again, having these will all become part of the personnel file for any particular employee, and that's sort of one category. Another category that emerges out of this field, however, is if there's any internal investigation performed by the company regarding the incident. And that gets us into a bit of another area where, again, documentation is crucial. Focusing on the process itself is just as important as whatever conclusion is reached as a result of the investigation. So there are really sort of those two components. The first component would be complying with the statutory regulatory obligations, and then any other internal investigation documents that are created by the company, those are really very important for the process that all employers should follow.
You know, one of the things, and I want to make sure we're continuing down this path, but one of the things that comes up is electronic record keeping, because there are more and more organizations using electronic files, electronic record keeping to keep not only employee files in, but documents that come into the organization. Does this change the process? Do we have to make sure there are secured files, non-secured files, access to these files, encryption? What are some of the things that are key in regards to this having to do with electronic files? And then, of course, we'll get back onto the details in terms of each specific area.
Well, I think you've mentioned some of them. You can certainly utilize computer resources to impose security measures, just like you would have a locked file cabinet in an HR office, and you would restrict access only to those who need to know. You don't want to store necessarily all the HR documents and the medical information on a common drive that all employees in the company can access. That's really probably a bad practice.
Bad idea.
Right. So you can utilize your security measures within the company's computer systems to restrict access to need to know. The one part I want to talk to people about when they start storing these records electronically, however, is just to recognize two important facts. One, information that's kept electronically has a way of spreading very quickly. Email propagates the number of people exponentially who have received documents. So it's, if you forwarded, for example, a performance evaluation back and forth between supervisors, it's very easy for that supervisor to just hit forward, and then ends up the whole department ends up seeing a otherwise confidential document. So there's some risk associated with that, and that needs to be part of a workplace policy that people understand, and part of the culture that people understand. Electronic communication of otherwise sensitive documents should be treated seriously. The other aspect is on the record retention piece of this. If you do have a written record retention plan, you need to make sure that it covers not just your paper files, but also your electronic records. And so if there are records that are kept electronically, some additional diligence is required to make sure that they're purged according to the schedule, because sometimes they end up on backup tapes, or they end up on other parts of the server, or held by custodians that were not necessarily initially contemplated as being recipients of these documents. And so if you're going to purge, in order for your record retention plan to really be effective, you've got to make sure you reach out to sort of all the repositories where the electronic copy of these files could be kept.
One of the things that I know HR professionals put in employee files is benefit forms. And they do, as I know, as well as most people know, have to be separate from others. But a lot of people keep benefit forms and medical records in the same file. So is that one of the areas where that's okay to combine those two? And B, what is it that they need to look at in regards to benefits that needs to be specifically why it's separated?
Well, I personally like to keep them separate, advise companies to keep them separate if possible. Again, the medical information raises some additional concerns, and you really want to try to keep that part of it accessible by only those people who need to know. The ordinary transactions of the benefits, you know, who they elect for their beneficiary, or what medical coverage they select and so forth, those sort of routine transactions are going to be memorialized most likely on forms provided by, in the instance I've just gave, by insurance companies or insurance carriers. Those sort of routine transactions, I think everybody has a pretty good handle on, just keeping them up to date, making sure that employees' information is constantly kept up to date when they move or they change elections and so forth. And the frequency with which companies now change health insurance providers, it seems like many companies change on it because the plans change so frequently, that I think everyone's kind of in the practice of reviewing those benefit election forms on a yearly basis.
So what are some of the forms that, and where do you think is the best place for individuals to keep forms regarding to performance evaluations or disciplinary actions?
The ultimate forms themselves should end up in the personnel file. The only exception to that, I would say, on the discipline side, is if there was some significant event that caused the company to perform an internal investigation. There was some really serious event that drew a lot of attention, and there was a lot of focus paid on that, to the extent that there was, you know, there were witness interviews and evidence gathered and a report issued. I would keep those separate from the personnel file. But the ultimate, at least until the investigation was concluded, and then I would put a lot of thought about the final work product that comes as a result of that investigation, and figure out whether that final report's going to go into the personnel file. The performance evaluation, the ultimate discipline dispensation form, those should go into the personnel file. Again, the takeaway is to really think of those as public documents, particularly on the discipline side. There's somewhat of an art to crafting those forms and the language to be used. Some of the tips are that you want to avoid characterizations. They want to be sort of just the facts, ma'am, kind of forms that are objective, that recite the steps that were followed, that recite who was involved in making the decision. If you've picked up on there being a real personality conflict or other clash between the supervisor and the employee, you want to get someone else involved and document that second person was actually involved and made the decision on the discipline side. On the performance evaluation side, I can't tell you the number of times I've been involved in cases where we are arguing on behalf of the employer that this employee was terminated for legitimate performance reasons, and we go back and look at performance evaluations, and they're all glowing. And I'm certainly not suggesting we go out of our way to put negative comments into performance evaluations for otherwise outstanding employees. But there have been times where we've run into supervisors who have told us after the fact, yeah, so-and-so was really not that great of an employee, but the supervisor just lacked the willingness to document in writing any of the legitimate critiques or criticisms. And again, you want to do it in an objective and fair way, avoiding characterizations. But the point is, if there are legitimate critiques and criticisms, they can be stated in a way that are in a positive and reinforcing, you know, we've noticed these few things, we want you to work on these in the upcoming year, and here's our plan to do it. And again, you have the employee review those, have an opportunity to write any comments, to weigh in, to be part of the process, and then ultimately sign off on receipt of the performance evaluation of the discipline, even if the employee disagrees with the conclusions stated in them.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We'll be right back with more Bulletproof Documentation Conversation. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Because you've booked with Booking.com, you, freedom lover, are on the road and carefree. You're not worried that dealership billboards spoil beautiful views or that the fresh, cool breeze gives you a mouthful of fumes. No, because you know in just a few more miles, you'll be free to rock around in the perfect Booking hotel, treehouse, or rustic cottage of your dreams. Thanks to Planet Earth's number one accommodation site, Booking.com. Booking.yeah!
If you'd like to be a guest on the HR Power Hour or be a show sponsor, send David an email today at info@hrpowerhour.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we are talking today with J.P. Harris. He's an employment attorney and litigator for the law firm of Sheehan Finney Bass and Green, which I might add is a great HR Power Hour sponsor. You know, JP, we've been talking about all the different files that go into the employee file. And by the way, today's topic, bulletproof documentation, is a great topic for HR professionals to really listen through and get some updates on what they think might be in their files. I'm sure you're surprised if you go in, HR professionals, you might be surprised what's actually in there. You know, JP, we've been talking about the information that goes in it, and we've had to separate some stuff. We've had to make sure it's right. Talk to me a little bit about terminations and documentation having to do with not only terminations, but just simply when somebody leaves, either voluntarily or involuntarily.
Well, there are some key forms that I'm sure your listeners are used to filling out. Change in status forms, calculating final wages, any vacation accrual that needs to be paid, COBRA information, benefits information. Those things are, I'm sure, everyone is used to doing. The part that we're trying to really impress upon employers is handling the exit interview and documenting that process as best they can. We recommend that employers generate a standard form or a checklist so that all departing employees are treated the same, and you either collect the same information or ask the same questions of each departing employee. And there are some things you need to do. Obviously, you want to take back possession of any physical assets, keys, and files, and so forth. One of the more difficult areas for employers these days is dealing with the electronic data, particularly where employees work from home, have access to your computer services from a home computer or use a smartphone. And so working out exactly how you're going to retrieve any company data that resides on a home computer or a smartphone, that process needs to be documented and handled. And the major benefit for having this exit interview process documented in this way is that it helps bolster any argument that the company might need to raise regarding its efforts to protect the confidentiality of its important data. One of the big weaknesses we see in trade secret cases and non-compete cases is when lots of employees are free to leave and no one really takes the time to make sure the company has collected back from them any important information they might possess either at home or on their smartphone.
When somebody looks at documentation for cell phone, company car, perks, you might say, and they may or may not, though they should, have a policy in regards to use of cell phones, use of company credit cards, use of company cars. What do you think needs to go in regards to the documentation of this? Does it need to go in employee files? How do you handle those other things that are important but not necessarily common?
I think that the items you've mentioned certainly would all go into this departing employee's personnel file, and you'd keep them that way. The cell phone part of it gets a lot of employers into a bit of a gray area because there's some employers pay for the smartphones themselves. Some of them have the bring-your-own-device type policies where the employees actually own the phone but are permitted to use it for work purposes. And so on those instances, you have this mixture of personal information and company information on the same device. We obviously recommend, we have sample bring-your-own-device policies that we've provided to employers where you lay out in advance when you're hiring someone or as you implement the policy before they leave, they know in advance what the expectations are, so that we're really trying to avoid any questions or any disputes at the cessation of the employment relationship, so that everybody knows what's expected of them. And it puts the employer in a better place to the extent you need to demonstrate you've acted in good faith and you're trying to protect legitimate company data. Just lays out the plan. You can think through the mechanics of the plan in advance, and hopefully it results in a smooth exit for this employee.
Other documents we haven't spoken about, not only from a termination standpoint, but just in general. How about workers' compensation documentation, or documentation that, as we're going to talk about, investigations? Where should those documents go?
Investigations, generally speaking, we like to keep them separate from the personnel files. The end product of that investigation might make its way into the personnel file in the form of some disciplinary record or even a termination decision. But the files themselves for the investigation we like to keep separate. The most important takeaway regarding investigations is that the process has to be fair. This is not the best place to be in as a litigator, but as a technical matter, the law tells us that employers can be wrong. They can investigate something and they can reach the wrong conclusion and still avoid liability. But if employers shortchange the process, and if they undertake investigations in a way that it appears like it was predetermined, the result was predetermined, employers cannot avoid liability for that. So the big tip is to focus as much on documenting the process that was followed as you do on reaching the ultimate conclusion. Documenting who was involved, what steps were undertaken, what information was considered. Documenting the process is just as important as reaching the right result at the end of an investigation.
What is it that, in regards to investigations, are some of the top tips that you think HR professionals, business leaders should really think about, since you're a litigator and you deal with the employment side, what are some of the things that you see that are common mistakes, common errors that, you know, not done maliciously, not done in a bad way, but just happen?
Right. The most common problem for litigators after the fact is when companies utilize the wrong person to conduct the investigation. You don't want to have the supervisor who has a history of problems with this employee. You don't want to have that supervisor run the investigation because it just casts a cloud over whatever conclusion, even if it's the right conclusion, just casts a cloud over the whole process. Oftentimes, employers want to use the supervisors because they're the person most knowledgeable about the operations in that department, and it just seems like the most efficient way. But if it's a significantly serious incident, you want to have somebody a bit detached undertake the investigation. So picking the right person is very important because that person is going to utilize his or her discretion right from the beginning about what information will be considered and what conclusions are drawn. So you really want to have the right person. Implementing temporary measures. Let's say that you're investigating a discrimination claim, a harassment claim brought by an employee against a supervisor. Implementing temporary measures to protect the employee who made the complaint from any further harassment while the investigation is going on, that's really important. That's also a bit of a trap, frankly, because sometimes the instinct would be, well, let's just transfer the employee to another department so they don't have to interact with the alleged harasser. A number of times employees will claim, well, that transfer was really retaliation. You sent me to a worse job, and I was not happy there, and so you're really retaliating against me for raising a complaint. So that's a very careful area to be wary about. Obviously, preserving confidentiality of the process, you want to limit information to only those people who need to know, again, to insulate yourself from retaliation claims. So those are some of the big key areas, and they're primarily aimed at avoiding retaliation claims flowing out of some complaint brought by an employee.
No, those make perfect sense. Those are important things. What do you think is, and I want to jump back for a minute because the one question I had was in regards to workman's comp. Where does that paperwork go?
The workers' comp paper, we generally speaking keep them as part of the personnel file. And again, the workers' comp paperwork is driven largely by regulation and by statute. And a lot of the paperwork will be driven by the carrier that provides coverage for the claim. So those records will be sort of dictated to the employer, and they'll be kept as part of the personnel file. Again, the only exception to that might be some internal investigation conducted by the company to investigate the incident that led to the accident. You can keep those separate for a period of time, and then ultimately the final product of that might make its way back into the personnel file.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We're talking about bulletproof documentation, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we're talking with the one and only J.P. Harris. He's an employment attorney and litigator with Shan Finney Bass and Green in Manchester, New Hampshire. We're talking about bulletproofing your documentation, which is really a very important topic. And if you've listened to the first part of this show, you'll certainly understand why. JP, we were talking about investigations, and is there anything you would like to finish up with as a couple like final tips for employers in this area?
There's one more piece that comes really from our court system and the rules and sanctions on companies that fail to preserve evidence that relates to a claim. Anytime a company reasonably anticipates there's a claim, they have an obligation to preserve any records in their possession that might relate to that claim. And the one thing I want to impart on HR professionals, and this is consistent with the theme we've been talking about, is document the process. Have a checklist or a chart that demonstrates when you sent out the litigation hold, who got it, what steps were taken to capture emails and other documents. Again, you want to have a document in your file that in one place summarizes all the steps and the process taken so you can demonstrate, if you're challenged, that you took reasonable steps to preserve information relating to a claim.
No, that's great. You know, one of the things that we then look at when we're talking about documentation is companies having a real record retention plan. And I know that sounds simple, and it probably is to most HR professionals. Oh, we have a kind of a plan of what we do, but there are rules that go along with this. There is, as we talked a little bit in the show, amount of times that people should be keeping certain documentations. There's some you keep, I would say, forever, and there are some that you can get rid of within that three-year period. How do we get our head wrapped around this? And what are some of the tips that you could provide to the listeners on putting a good record retention plan together?
Well, my first tip is to not create a plan that has too many retention periods. We touched on this a little bit. I like to have, within any given department, try to have two or three retention periods. So one will be permanent. One will be employment plus 7 years is pretty common, and one will be 2 or 3 years. And every document sent, created, received by that department will be categorized into one of those three buckets. And that's pretty easy for employers to police and to enforce. A real practical tip is that I like to try to get companies to pick one time each year where they're actually going to do the purge. It's very difficult to get employees to take time out of their busy days to go back and calculate, well, now I've got emails in my file that are now more than 3 years old, so I'm going to delete those handful. Employees don't have time to do that every day. But if you set up a time, let's say December of every year, we're going to go back and review our files and see what needs to be purged. It's much easier to get employees to focus on that one time a year rather than this sort of rolling purge where every day a new document becomes stale or worthy of purging. Again, you could spend hours and hours researching all the available regulations, particularly in the HR field where you've got a federal and a state overlay, and you could come up with this very complicated plan. But my advice to employers is really to try to pick a couple of periods and just have the HR professionals and HR staff just try to maintain the 3 periods rather than the 20 or 30, frankly, you could come up with if you pulled every regulation on both the state and federal level.
So when somebody has this plan, they should make sure it's documented, right? I mean, I know we're talking about documentation, but that documentation of what the record retention plan should be written down, correct?
The plan has to be written down, otherwise you'll lose the protection afforded to you by the court systems. The U.S. Supreme Court has said employers may purge documents. They can get rid of information that might otherwise be relevant to a future claim so long as it's done pursuant to a written plan. And the plan has to have this sort of escape clause, this temporary litigation hold if there is an actual claim. But if you're just operating your ordinary business and you have a written plan, and you purge something that years later turns out to be important to a claim, you will avoid sanctions. But if you don't have a plan and employees are just purging things willy-nilly or more frequently holding on to everything forever, you will either face sanctions for losing information you should have kept, or you'll have the opposite problem where you have so much information that it's costly and very difficult to find the few pieces of paper that are actually important to the given claim. It drives up your litigation expense, makes the management of the case more difficult, and aside from dealing with claims, it makes you a little less efficient because you have a lot of clutter hanging around, just like my garage at home. I have a lot of clutter. It makes it more difficult for me to find the one or two things I'm really looking for when I need them.
Are there any other tips, as we get ready to wrap up the show today, that you think would be really effective for HR professionals to think about at the end here to make sure their files are truly bulletproof?
The couple of takeaways I really want to impart to people are, one, think of your documents as public documents. Even though they sit in a locked file cabinet and they belong to some employee's personnel file, you have to have that part of your brain that examines them through the lens of them being an exhibit someday, God forbid, in a trial or otherwise being made public. So think about the documents as public documents. That should help give you some barometer about the language to be used or the text to be used, particularly in any sort of discretionary documents, performance evaluations, narratives, investigation files. And the other big takeaway is to really focus on documenting the process followed. We talked about a few instances where you really need to document that you've given employees a fair opportunity to review documents before they sign them. So you need to have a document in your file that demonstrates that, yes, I gave this employee a couple of days to review a non-compete before they accepted the job. Again, if you have investigations or other claims, to really document the process to be followed, because that's just as important as the ultimate conclusion that you draw.
Well, thank you very much, JP, for being on the show today. You've provided absolutely great information, and anybody interested in hearing more or connecting with JP can go to the HRPowerHour.com website. His information, bio, and contact information will be there, and they can connect with you directly. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And now your HR tip of the week. According to the article, 30 Powerful Tips to Be an Outstanding HR Professional by Paul Sorin, the top five tips are: you need to have an HR specialty. 2, HR results matter a lot, but relationships, remember, matter more. 3, if you're an HR leader, nothing will make you look better than a talented HR team. 4, stay current and on top of your HR game. Just when you think you're winning the rat race, along comes another faster rat. And then 5, what others say about your HR reputation is 10 times more convincing than what you say. So even if you're 10 times more accurate, make sure that the delivery is there. That's your HR tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to have a great guest. He's a returning lawyer, now VP of HR for Maine Medical Center and Maine Health. His name is Matt Ball. He's a great guy. He's going to be talking about his unexpected HR career. Learn from him and your career will succeed. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.